Okay, this is lesson 8 in our survey of Judges. And last week I had hoped to cover chapter 6 and 7, and we only finished 6. And this week we will endeavor to take chapters 7 and 8 together. And I don't have any new artwork for you guys. So I'm going to assume that the artwork last week left a lasting impression. If you want to come look at it later, you're more than welcome to. So let's look at chapter 7, beginning in verse 1. Then Zerubbabel, that is Gideon, and all the people who were with him rose early and encamped beside the well of Herod, so that the camp of the Midianites was on the north side of them by the hill of Morah in the valley. And the Lord said to Gideon, "The people who are with you are too many for me to give the Midianites into your hands, lest Israel claim glory for itself against me, saying, 'My own hand has saved me.' Now therefore proclaim in the hearing of the people, saying, 'Whoever is fearful and afraid, let him turn and depart at once from Mount Gilead.' And 22,000 of the people returned, and 10,000 remained." On the map up here, you can see these episodes are taking place in the valley of Jezreel, this low-lying plain to the west of the Jordan. And here is this blue dot. Here is the hill of Morah, and Endor is another town location close by that we've been reading about. And we'll see how the battle takes place down in here as well. But this gives you an idea of where they're located. They're on one side of the hill, and the Midianites are on the other. Now, Gideon's army is assembled. He's issued the call. 32,000 people answered that call, and they show up ready for battle. And they are located just down the road, as it were, and on the other side of the valley of this army, this assembled army of the Midianites, and who are preparing themselves for battle. And I cannot imagine harder news to receive as a battle commander than to have God tell you that you have just too many people here to fight the battle. I can't imagine anything being harder to swallow than that. But God is very jealous of His glory, isn't He? And there isn't any concern in His mind as to who will actually win the battle or what will transpire during the battle. He's got every detail under control. But yet He does not want Israel to vaunt itself where they should not. And when you think of the goodness of God, and given the inclination of the people up to this time, you can see that God is not going to lead His people into temptation. The temptation to believe they are stronger than they actually are, and that they have won the battle. So God is good to His people, even in this midst. Gideon dismisses the fearful, the timid, and the faint-hearted, and he issues this broad summons, makes this pronouncement that anybody who's scared can go home. And quite a number of them do. And it makes you wonder why so many of them really didn't want to fight. Deuteronomy 20 and verse 8 has provision that when you go to war, that everyone who is afraid ought to be able to come home. Well, I don't know the exact layout of all the geography involved with this particular battle, but it appears as if the enemy was encamped throughout the valley of Jezreel, throughout a broad plain, if you will, probably on somewhat level ground for whatever advantage they could gain from that. And that the Israelites, as they had assembled, were able to look down and see this vast army that had come together to fight them. Well, I think that in and of itself would have been enough to make anyone timid. How are we ever going to pull this off with so many people out there? But it still, 10,000 of them remained. Many of them did want to go home, but 10,000 of them said, no, we're ready for battle. I think seeing that many soldiers arrayed before you, it doesn't tell us how many here, we'll see that in a little bit, but they were outnumbered. It was 120,000 that had assembled. When you see this vast number and you've got 32,000, you've already had a disadvantage. But I found one comment that I thought was helpful, and it came from Matthew Henry, and I think he's I think he's referencing some other material, but he says, some think the oppression that they had been under so long had broken their spirits. Others, more probably, that consciousness of their own guilt had deprived them of their courage. Sin stared them in the face, and therefore they durst not look death in the face. That they had been living for a long time under oppression, and they knew to fight this battle could mean sudden death, and they were not right with God, and there was no reason to think that they would get a free ride. If you recall, the prophet had been through the town and through the area proclaiming the repentance and that they needed to follow the Lord with their whole heart. So Gideon is already on the eve of this battle, assembling his men, realizing he's got way too many. So let's look in verse 4 here and see what happens next. But the Lord said to Gideon, "The people are still too many. Bring them down to the water, and I will test them for you here. Then it will be that of whom I say to you, this one shall go with you, the same shall go with you. And of whomever I say to you, this one shall not go with you, the same shall not go." So he brought the people down to the water. And the Lord said to Gideon, "Everyone who laps from the water with his tongue as a dog laps, you shall set apart by himself. Likewise, everyone who gets down on his knees to drink." And the number of those who lapped, putting their hand to their mouth, was 300 men. But all the rest of the people got down on their knees to drink water. Then the Lord said to Gideon, "By the 300 men who lapped, I will save you and deliver the Midianites into your hand. Let all the other people go, every man to his place." So the people took provisions and their trumpets in their hands, and he sent away all the rest of Israel, every man to his tent, and retained those 300 men. Now the camp of Midian was below him in the valley. So this is really quite a bizarre incident when you think about it. God tells Gideon, now you've got 10,000 men who want to fight, 10,000 men to take on the 120,000 or so Midianites that are against you. But you've got too many of them. You've got to narrow these guys down. And I'll tell you what to do. We'll decide who fights based on how they like to drink water. You know, that's really quite an odd thing when you think about it. But it does show that it... you know, God is God's in control of all these things. He put it in the hearts of some men to drink one way, and put it in the hearts of others to drink another way. And the water spoken here is a place that's thought to be called Herod's Well, and I'm not. It comes up in a few other places, but I don't think it has much prominence otherwise. And it struck me as an altogether odd way of categorizing your soldiers, that you're going to bring this army together and you've already let the fearful go. Well, that's at least somewhat understandable. Now you're going to recategorize those who remain of the 10,000. And I'm sure Gideon didn't realize how many were going to be left after the discrimination, after they went through the selection process. By the way, Bill, does the Academy have a checkbox for whether you're a lapper or a knee drinker? I'm not sure. Okay, well, we'll wonder about that.
I did hear a World War II veteran talk about the strategy of this business of how to drink, and he's guessing as well as anybody else, but he says, you know, as they came over the hill and saw the water, they were famished, and most of them just threw themselves into the thing and said, finally water. But the rest of them watch for the enemy as they drink.
That's right.
Never drop their eyes for the horizon.
Yeah.
But that's speculation too.
And that's the best explanation that I've heard. I've seen that explanation given, that those who were being watchful and did not want to take their eye off what was happening, the rest decided to drink all they could while they had a chance. In verse 8, we read that Gideon dismisses all the rest of Israel to go home. And this phrase of all the rest of Israel, or the men of Israel, or something, it's not something that we find common. It's not a phrase common in the book of Judges. We find more frequently that there are regional references. So I think that you have an incident here where men from many different tribes have come together and decided to fight. And this is where Gideon, one of the reasons why Gideon is given such prominence in the book is that he represented not one small area, but rather a very large area of Israel and a very large area of the oppression. Gideon and Samson, far and away, comprise the bulk of the book of Judges, and there's good reason for it. The exploits under Gideon are quite significant in the history of Israel. Let's look in verse 9. It happened on the same night that the Lord said to him, "Arise, go down against the camp, for I have delivered it into your hand. But if you are afraid to go down, go down to the camp with Purah, your servant, and you shall hear what they say. And afterward your hand shall be strengthened to go down against the camp." Then he went down with Purah, his servant, to the outpost of the armed men who were in the camp. Now the Midianites and the Amalekites and all the people of the east were lying in the valley as numerous as locusts, and their camels were without number, as the sand by the seashore in multitude. And when Gideon had come, there was a man telling a dream to his companion. He said, "I have had a dream. To my surprise, a loaf of barley bread tumbled into the camp of Midian. It came to a tent and struck it so that it fell and overturned, and the tent collapsed." Then his companion answered and said, "This is nothing else but the sword of Gideon, the son of Joash, a man of Israel. Into his hand God has delivered Midian and the whole camp." And so it was, when Gideon heard the telling of the dream and its interpretation, that he worshipped. He returned to the camp of Israel and said, "Arise, for the Lord has delivered the camp of Midian into your hand." We find again that God speaks to Gideon during the night, and I don't suppose that he had to wake him this time in order to tell him of his new option to discover what was going on in the camp. It doesn't say he was sleeping, and no one would fault him if he wasn't. But God does come to him and says, if you're fearful about this, if you're uncertain as to what's going to happen, then by all means, I want you to go do such and such. I think that was probably one of those times when you can see the real mercy of God in confirming faith in his people to do what he has commanded them to do. Last week we mentioned the presence of this, or the exercise of this fleece, and how Gideon used this fleece to strengthen his faith and to strengthen the faith of the men that were with him by such a clear testimony as to what God endeavored to accomplish through them. And here we see Gideon again needing the assurances and God graciously granting them. God knowing what he needed and sending him down there to give him the news that he so desperately longed for. It might be worth mentioning, as you look at this passage with Gideon and his exploits, that he is fearful at times. And although most of you are probably not familiar with the teaching that can be found more in the charismatic movements, there is a large number of Christians who look at this idea of being fearful as the opposite of faith. And fear is not the opposite of faith. Unbelief is the opposite of believing. Being fearful about what God has said will happen is not unbelief. A person could be quite fearful of the coming of the Lord Jesus Christ in one sense, and seeing the majesty of God, and that wouldn't be unbelief. But Gideon has shown himself to be, by God's own description, a man of valor, a man who was strong, but here he is quite afraid, and God grants him the comfort that he needs. Now, even if you think about it for a minute, what God had told Gideon he could do to strengthen his faith was to head down to the Midianite camp and go listen to what's going on. Well, even that took a lot of guts. These guys were down there without number, with camels everywhere, like the sand of the seashore. Couldn't count them, there were so many. Well, just go down. Listen to what they have to say. Why don't we send somebody else down, God? Why do we have to go down? But he sends him down there, and he goes. Well, I think Gideon was quite astonished at what he heard when he arrived at the camp to discover that the Midianites were deathly afraid of Gideon and what God had already done. It's a good thing that Gideon took Purah down with him to witness what had been spoken, because I don't know that anybody would have believed it on the testimony of just one person. Henry also makes a comment about the conversation that Gideon overhears. He said, if Gideon had heard the dream only, and he and his servant had been left to interpret it themselves, it had so little significance in it that it would have done him little service. But having the interpretation from the mouth of the enemy, it not only appeared to come from God, who has all men's hearts and tongues in his hand, but it was likewise an evidence that the enemy was quite dispirited and that the name of Gideon had become so formidable to them that it disturbed their sleep. So when you examine just a little more closely what actually happens here, you can see that God is giving Gideon comfort all the way around. Imagine if he had gone down and just heard this guy. I had a dream about this barley cake, this flour that came down and squashed the tent. I could imagine the other guy saying, dude, what'd you have for dinner? But God gives the interpretation of this dream, and they realize that the whole camp is very much afraid of what's about to happen. Immediately upon receiving this good news, Gideon worships God. His first reaction is to worship God, God who had given him such comfort and had delivered the enemy into his hands. After returning to the home base, Gideon strengthens his men by assuring them that God has won the victory for them. It's a done deal at this point. All right, let's look at verse 16. Then he divided the 300 men into three companies, and he put a trumpet into every man's hand with empty pitchers and torches inside the pitchers. And he said to them, look at me and do likewise. Watch, and when I come to the edge of the camp, you shall do as I do. When I blow the trumpet, I and all who are with me, then you also blow the trumpets on every side of the whole camp and say, the sword of the Lord and of Gideon. So Gideon and the 300 men who were with him came to the outpost of the camp at the beginning of the middle watch, just as they had posted the watch, and they blew the trumpets and broke the pitchers that were in their hands. Then the three companies blew the trumpets and broke the pitchers. They held the torches in their left hands and their trumpets in their right hands for blowing. And they cried, the sword of the Lord and of Gideon. And every man stood in his place all around the camp, and the whole army ran and cried out and fled. When the 300 blew the trumpets, the Lord set every man's sword against his companion throughout the whole camp, and the army fled to Beth Akakia toward Zerah, as far as the border of Abel Meholah by Tabith. And I marked these two cities. So these guys are in this valley of Jezreel, up in this area. And here is Abel Meholah, and here is Tabith. So they've already got a pretty good run going. They're being so frightened to cover that distance in the dead of night when Gideon attacks. Now Gideon, tactically speaking, is smart enough to realize that 300 men with 300 swords is not going to do much to rout an enemy of this particular size, and they weren't going to take this battle very far. So one of the things it appears that he did before they dismissed either the whole group or the 10,000 is he acquired all the trumpets he could lay his hands on, and he ended up with 300 trumpets and 300 pitchers. Now, at first, I'm not sure how much sense that would have made to those giving up their musical instruments and their water pitchers. But Gideon at least had the foresight to come up with all of this, because if you end up separating the camp into three separate groups, three groups of 100 each, and spreading them out, when Gideon starts the battle, those guys are so terrified of the host coming that they think they're obviously much more. There's a great vast number of people, because I don't know what the ratio of trumpeters to soldiers were, but maybe they had one per 500 or 600 or whatever the number was. You can imagine hearing 300 of these things, thinking that there are just tens of thousands of men coming over the hills to do battle. Well, it appears like it did work. He wanted everyone to strike fear into the hearts of the enemy, who were already afraid, but to do so two different ways. One, by making a lot of noise and making them think that they were vastly outnumbered. And second, he wanted to strike fear into their hearts that their doom had come by the hand of the Lord. Now, when he went down into the camp, the men who had the dream said they were afraid of Gideon, for God had delivered them. And so when Gideon makes the men shout, the sword of the Lord and of Gideon, he's not trying to bring undue honor upon himself. He knows that's exactly the sound that these men do not want to hear. The Midianites do not want to hear, because they're all afraid of this little barley loaf. Gideon also shows himself to be a real leader. In verse 17, he tells the men, this is what's going to happen, and I want you to follow me just as and do exactly what I'm going to do. He wasn't stationing himself or positioning himself far away for the battle, but close up so that his men could do the same as he was. All right, in verse 23... And the men, a little bit of this takes place at the end of 7 here and also chapter 8. If you remember early on, I told you that the book of Judges was not written as a strict chronological account. There are times when you're reading the story here, and then he goes to another area, and he comes back, and we saw that in chapters 1 and 2 with the intermingling of the accounts of Joshua and Caleb and such. Well, here, I think, is another instance of what's happening in another place. And so it's not necessarily strictly chronological. And the men of Israel gathered together from Naphtali, Asher, and all Manasseh, and pursued the Midianites. Well, who were these men? Well, they were the very ones who had assembled themselves together, but were dismissed because of fear or water drinking habits. Their willingness to fight for Israel is being put to the test now because the army is on the run, and they're going to do all that they can to stop those who are escaping. And there are a fair number of people who are trying to escape. Gideon did not slaughter the whole army, nor did they slaughter themselves, the complete army, in this one section. But all of these are more northern tribes, and it says all of Manasseh, so you've got Manasseh right about here, and Manasseh up on the right-hand side. So you've got all these guys coming together to flee the army that was over here by Abel, Mealoha, and Tabith. So now you've got the army of Israel assembled together chasing these men. Verse 24, then Gideon sent messengers throughout all the mountains of Ephraim. Now, just here would have been all the mountains of Ephraim down in here. So he's sending some more guys down in this part to assemble. He said, come down against the Midianites and seize from the watering places as far as Bethbara and the Jordan. Then all the men of Ephraim gathered together and seized the watering places as far as Bethbara and the Jordan. And they captured two princes of the Midianites, Oreb and Zeb. They killed Oreb at the rock of Oreb, and Zeb they killed at the winepress of Zeb. They pursued Midian and brought the heads of Oreb and Zeb to Gideon on the other side of the Jordan. Well, so Gideon isn't taking any chances with these guys and wants to make sure that all of the enemy is captured. He's intent on destroying every last one. Not just winning the battle, but on utter destruction. Now, we don't have any idea right now where this Bethbara or the wine press of Zeb or the rock of Oreb. We don't know where those places are at, but it doesn't really matter, I guess. Where they were, they may have been found at their homes or their new locations where they had been residing while they were occupiers in the land. It's not so much where they were killed, but that they were killed and they were unable to escape is what the scriptures want us to remember. And the defeat of Oreb and Zeb, they're listed as the princes, but they probably were a little more on the military side. So these could have been the commanders. And we saw the same sort of distinction with Sisera and Jabin in the account earlier on in Deborah. So Isaiah 10:25 makes mention of these guys, and I didn't write the reference, but as well as Psalm 83. So in the history of Israel, they look back at the killing of Oreb and Zeb, and Zeba and Zalmunna, as we'll see shortly. They look back on these things as kind of a signal deliverance that God had given, something that should be remembered for many years to come. So before we rush in to tackle chapter 8, we'll pause here and see if there are any comments or questions. Okay. Finishing the battle, chapter 8. Now the men of Ephraim said to him, why have you done this to us by not calling us when you went to fight with the Midianites? And they reprimanded him sharply. So he said to them, what have I done now in comparison with you? Is not the gleaning of the grapes of Ephraim better than the vintage of Abiezer? God has delivered into your hands the princes of Midian, Oreb and Zeb. And what was I able to do in comparison with you? Then their anger toward him subsided when he had said that. It's kind of a strange passage in the midst of what's happening, but I think one of the purposes of showing this is just how good of a leader Gideon is. After the capture of Oreb and Zeb, these Ephraimites that had just assembled themselves together and had gone out to battle decide to take their new leader to task for not involving them from the very beginning of the work. They profess to have great zeal in accomplishing and prosecuting this battle, but it does make you wonder where all this great zeal was before Gideon came along. They weren't fighting any of the Midianites then. Where were they? Hiding in the dens and the caves and the rocks and the holes, trying to stay away from the Midianites. And now they're saying, hey, you should have called us from the beginning, and we could have done a little bit more. Well, I think what you see here is the humility of Gideon as he brings soft words to assuage their anger. Did they have a just cause to be angry? No, I don't believe so. But, you know, on what basis would they have? Because he didn't invite them to the battle like they wanted to be? Well, Gideon was right in not involving them in the battle because God directed Gideon as to who should be involved in the battle and at what time. God told him, you get rid of these guys and you get rid of those guys and you keep these men right here. For all we know, the Ephraimites might have been part of the 22,000 who were timid or afraid just the other day. So we really don't know why they weren't as a tribe, but why they weren't involved, but the point is, it was God's call, not Gideon's, to decide who was going to be in the battle. I think Gideon puts about the best possible light that you could imagine in showing that he is strong in his ordination to this office, this commission that God has given him. He describes his valor and in light of theirs, he calls it the gleaning of the grapes being bent better than the vintage of Abiezer, which was his family name. Well, as we'll see, there were 120,000 people involved in this battle, and about 15,000 of them appeared to have escaped, and then another group went over that the Ephraimites caught. And Gideon's saying, look, I did what I was called to do. You don't like it. You're angry with God. Take it up with him. But leave me out of it. I didn't do anything wrong. And besides, I've just slain thousands of men in the hill country there. He doesn't. Very confidently says, what's the vintage of Abiezer compared to the gleaning of the grapes of Ephraim? You know, this guy is very confident in his calling that God has given him, and he's not worried about some young upstart upsetting him. In verse 4, when Gideon came to the Jordan, he and the 300 men who were with him crossed over, exhausted but still in pursuit. Then he said to the men of Succoth, please give loaves of bread to the people who follow me, for they are exhausted. And I am pursuing Zeba and Zalmunna, kings of Midian. And the leaders of Succoth said, are the hands of Zeba and Zalmunna now in your hand that we should give bread to the army, to your army? So Gideon said, for this cause, when the Lord has delivered Zeba and Zalmunna into my hand, then I will tear your flesh with the thorns of the wilderness and with briars. And then he went up from there to Penuel and spoke to them in the same way. And the men of Penuel answered him as the men of Succoth had answered. So he also spoke to the men of Penuel, saying, when I come back in peace, I will tear down this tower. Well, this is really an odd encounter that Gideon has. And here are the towns that are referred to. So these guys started up here in the valley of Jezreel. Some of them had gone over here. I suspect the Ephraimites coming from here maybe got those guys, or the assembled tribe of Manasseh on this side of the Jordan. But one of the things that didn't happen, that should have happened, was they needed to close the fords of the Jordan so that the men could not cross the river. And they would have ended up saving themselves a great deal of effort, but they couldn't get these fords crossed. So here you've got the river Jabbok, which is, there's a reference to those that dwell in tents, and it's thought that it's probably this area and this river. But you have Succoth and Penuel right here that are more or less river towns going out to the east. This was also, I believe, one of the first things that Jeroboam did was rebuild the tower of Penuel when he became king, to strengthen this eastern frontier that they had so that they could bring a watch against anybody who would attack. So considering they started up here by the hill of Morah and are now down here with the same 300 men hot in pursuit, you can imagine how tired these guys would have been. And this is all the more reason why the men of Succoth and Penuel have no excuse whatsoever for their treatment of Gideon. Well, Gideon and his army cross over here, still in pursuit of the Midianites. And this is one of the remarkable the contrasts that are offered in the book of Judges, because if you remember early on, the criticism of the judges, of the people prior to the judges, was that they would not drive out the inhabitants of the town or inhabitants of the land. And Gideon shows himself to be very different than the other judges in terms of his degree of executing judgment on behalf of God. He is intent not only on winning the battle. They've already driven these guys out. They've decimated the army. There are only 15,000 of them left. I mean, only 15,000. But there are only 15,000 left compared to what they had before. But that doesn't content Gideon. He's not content to simply driving out the bulk of these people so they can live in peace again. He's pursuing these guys across the river, through these towns, out into the wilderness, so that he might destroy every single one of them. Henry makes this, I thought, very helpful remark on this passage. He said, Gideon expected more from 300 men supported by a particular promise than from so many thousands supported by their own valor. You know, we cannot separate what these people are doing from an act of faith. These people have their trust in God's deliverance. Even when Gideon is receiving the rough words of the men of Succoth and Penuel, he emphasizes to them, when I come back after God has delivered these people into my hands, then I'm going to come back and deal with you guys as I should. So even in his distress and his fatigue, he still recognizes that God is the one who is delivering the men. Well, the request for food and aid, hold on just a minute, let me finish this section here. The request for food and aid are refused, and it strikes me as so uncharitable for these men to not even offer food and water to fellow Israelites. There were only 300 of these men, and I suspect they knew that there were 15,000 Midianites hot on a run, being chased by 300, and think, wow, these guys are vastly outnumbered. We don't want to get on the wrong side here, and we don't want to aid and abet these 300 rebels. When they end up getting crushed, the Midianites come back and harass us. There's no question that the odds were definitely against Midian, but the odds were not the deciding factor as to who was going to win. All I can think of is that either they were wholly ignorant of Gideon's appointment as a judge, or they were completely devoid of faith and love. I'm not sure which is the better criticism. They were under obligation to lend at least this much simple assistance to the troops, but it would appear that they neither supported the war nor the troops. Henry again makes a comment on the actions of the men of this city. He says that he expected, Gideon, not that the magistrates should meet them in their formalities, congratulate him upon his victory, present him with the keys of their city, and give him a treat, much less that they should send forces to his assistance, though he was entitled to all this. But he only begged some necessary food for his soldiers, that they were already ready to faint for want, and he does so humbly and importantly. He says, "Give, I pray you, loaves of bread unto me and unto the people that follow me." You know, this was an act out of pure selfishness, and the men of Succoth and Penuel are going to pay for it. Now, I think in the sake of time, we'll move on here a little bit. There is one comment I want to read. I'll do that in a little bit. Gideon reminds these men, "I'm the civil magistrate of this land, and there's a new sheriff in town." And he says, "You guys are going to pay for this misdeed when I come back." So confident is he of the victory that he's confident that when he returns, he'll be able to repay them for their ingratitude and their faithfulness. All right, Bill, did you have a comment?
I have a question.
Okay. Oh, okay. Let's move on to verse 10. Then Zeba and Zalmunna were at Karkor, and their enemies with them, about 15,000, and all who were left of the army of the people of the east. The 120,000 men who drew the sword had fallen. Then Gideon went up by the road of those who dwell in the tents of the east, of Nobah and Jogbeth, and he attacked the army while the camp felt secure. When Zeba and Zalmunna fled, he pursued them, and he took the two kings of Midian, Zeba and Zalmunna, and routed the whole army. This is this Jogbeha down here. So they've come up here, and they've got a lot of ground to cover, considering they started up here, and they couldn't even pick up supplies on the way after they had crossed the river. So here we have 300 very tired men chasing 15,000 with 120,000 already dead. What other instances are there in Scripture where we see these kinds of numbers of the enemy of Israel falling at one time? You know, we don't have specific numbers from my recollection of the Egyptians who perished, although I'm sure there's a fair number. I doubt there were this many. When the Syrians, wasn't it, came, 185,000 died in one night. Well, here we have 120,000 died. This is a battle that is often overlooked in the history of Israel in terms of its majesty. They've got Zeba and Zalmunna on the run, and these guys are running as fast as they can. So Gideon caught these men down by Jogbeha, and just considering the distance they had to travel makes their pursuit all the more impressive. Verse 13. Then Gideon, the son of Joash, returned from battle and from the ascent of Heres. Now, just by the way, that ascent of Heres is a bit troubling to translate. Some people thought, or still think, that it has more to do with these men had pursued through the night, and the ascent of Heres means they were capturing these men until sunup. And he caught a young man of Succoth and interrogated him, and he wrote down for him the leaders of Succoth and its elders, 77 men. Then he came to the men of Succoth and said, "Here are Zeba and Zalmunna, about whom you ridiculed me, saying, 'Are the hands of Zeba and Zalmunna now in your hand, that we should give bread to your weary men?' And he took the elders of the city, and thorns of the wilderness and briars, and with them he taught the men of Succoth." That's an interesting phrase. He taught the men of Succoth. Then he tore down the tower of Penuel and killed the men of the city. Well, Gideon, fresh from his victory, returns to the two cities to make good on his word. Now, he's not acting from some sort of personal slight, vengeance. He's upset that they wouldn't help him personally in his own little rebellion. He's a civil magistrate. It's well within his purview to punish these men for what they failed to do. And this may seem like an odd thing to mention, but I believe it is important. There's quite a bit of debate as to the dating of the book of Judges. Some people put it late in Israel's future. Some people put it very early in Israel's future or Israel's history. But if this narrative took place well into ancient history, a long, long time ago, well past the 1000 to 1500 BC that I think most evangelicals are leaning toward, I don't think the men of Succoth, that the man that they found, would have been writing the names of the individuals who were the elders of the city. So this phrase gives us some help in seeing that, you know, early on, I doubt he sketched out their faces in the sand and said, "Here, this guy, he's got a crooked smile. You want to catch him, you can always get him at the coffee shop." You know, I suspect they had writing tools, they had something to write on, and he wrote. Well, that's an important piece of information in the overall dating of this book, that these guys were not in the Stone Age, and they were very well advanced. Now, this punishment that Gideon wants to inflict on these guys strikes us as a bit bizarre and even a little on the barbaric side. And it's precisely accounts like this that you'll find pique the interest of many commentators, including this one. I'm going to read a quote from Kiddo, who is citing some material in the Pictorial Bible. I thought it was real helpful. It's a little squeamish, but it's real helpful. He cites, "In northern nations, where the body is completely covered, the idea of such punishments with thorns on the naked person seems a far-fetched device. But in the east, where the clothing leaves much more of the person exposed, and where, in consequence, men are constantly lacerating their skins and passing through thickets, the idea of such laceration is always kept present to the mind, either by actual experience of the suffering or by the constant observation of it. Thus, tearing the flesh with thorns comes to be a familiar idea of penal infliction, and as such is still popularly mentioned in the East as among the punishments which evildoers deserve or will obtain, not only in this life, but in the life to come. So there are two thoughts as to how they probably did this, according to the well-known research, that they either stripped these men and flogged them, as it were, with the briars, or they assembled a large patch of thorns and briars and put the men on them and ran over them with threshing instruments to press them into the briars. Either way sounds particularly painful, but apparently they consider this adequate punishment for failing to help quarter soldiers. All right, verse 18. And he said to Zebah and Zalmunna...
Pictures of that?
I don't have pictures. I looked for pictures of that. I did. I don't have pictures of that. I wish I did. That's probably too much for you, most of your Sunday school marms. And he said to Zebah and Zalmunna, what kind of men were they whom you killed at Tabor? Now, I have Tabor up here. I forget where Tabor is at. I think it's in this area right here. I'll have to look that up. And he answered, as you are, so were they. Each one resembled the son of a king. He said, they were my brothers, the sons of my mother. As the Lord lives, if you had let them live, I would not kill you. And he said to Jether, his firstborn, rise, kill them. But the youth would not draw his sword, for he was afraid, because he was still a youth. So Zebah and Zalmunna said, rise yourself and kill us, for as a man is, so is his strength. So Gideon arose and killed Zebah and Zalmunna, and took the crescent ornaments that were on their camels' necks. Now the line of questioning directed here toward Zebah and Zalmunna is not toward their terror over Israel as a whole, but rather the murder of someone in Gideon's family. It appears that these men had either ordered or participated in the murder of some close relative of Gideon. Gideon was executing justice for Israel's sake, but he is also repaying the men for the evil inflicted upon his family. I don't know why exactly the scriptures detail that his son would not draw his sword to kill the men. Maybe, if nothing more, to show that nepotism was alive and unsuccessful in the old days, as well as often is the case today. Doesn't really say. But we're running out of time here, and I do want to finish this. Let's get on to 22. Then the men of Israel said to Gideon, rule over us, both you and your son, and your grandson also, for you have delivered us from the hand of Midian. But Gideon said to them, I will not rule over you, nor shall my son rule over you. The Lord shall rule over you. Then Gideon said to him, I would like to make a request of you, that each of you would give me the earrings from his plunder. For they had golden earrings, because they were Ishmaelites. And so they answered, we will gladly give them. And they spread out a garment, and each man threw into it the earrings from his plunder. Now the weight of the gold earrings that he had requested was 1,700 shekels of gold, beside the crescent ornaments, pendants, and purple robes which were on the kings of Midian, and beside the chains that were around their camels' necks. Then Gideon made it into an ephod, and set it up in his city, Orpha. And all Israel played the harlot with it there, and it became a snare to Gideon and his house. Well, at this point, since the battle is over and Israel's once again free, they decide that they need a king. And I don't think the reasons are not given, but I doubt there's any significant difference as to why they wanted a king now than why they wanted one in the days of the latter judges, namely Samuel. And the people have clearly have in mind a hereditary monarchy, for they want Gideon's line to hold a perpetual or permanent rule over them. And Gideon is humble enough and smart enough to realize that God hadn't called him to be a king, and it would be wrong for him to be appointed to such a position. However, I'm not quite so sure that Gideon wasn't acting like a king through some of this time, or perhaps just a bit more specifically, that his children didn't think that he was acting as a king. That's going to come up more in the next chapter, although we'll hit it here in just a minute. But Gideon asked the people, I'd like to have your earrings, I'd like to have the spoils of the war, and they end up giving him about 40-some pounds, maybe 50 pounds worth of gold for him to use. And perhaps he used that gold, or he used it to hire someone to make this ephod that they ended up using, that became the snare to them. I don't know why it was so popular for earrings, but Exodus 32 has the reference to Aaron building the golden calf and the people contributed their earrings to it. And so, you know, I don't understand the significance of it, but it's quite possible that these earrings having the crescent ornaments that's mentioned were probably symbols of the Ashtoreth, which I think was the goddess of the moon, and Baal was the goddess of the sun. All of Israel ended up whoring after this ephod that was commissioned or made by Gideon. And it also mentions that these things took place in Ophrah, Gideon's hometown. Now, I want to make one very important point about this that kind of underlies the whole of the text of the book of Judges. And everything that I'm going to say here and everything I've read argues from some degree or another from silence, but I think there's a good point to it. And the scriptures often compress in time what takes place. So you read the book of the Acts of the Apostles, you think, wow, all these miracles happen. I mean, every day this stuff's happening. Well, the whole book took place over many years. And the same thing is happening here. Gideon's rule over Israel lasted a long time, but the scriptures are compressing what took place into just a short sentence or two. And the details of how they got there are not given to us, but simply the conclusion of what took place. So this is what I think has happened, and I'd say this is probably the consensus of many commentators. Gideon creates this ephod, which ought to bring to mind the priestly robe that was worn in Israel. And he wears it on various occasions. Remember, he was commissioned to build an altar and commissioned to offer a sacrifice, but that was not a new permanent altar that was in Israel, but only a one-time altar that God had told him to build. But over time, this ephod takes on a life of its own. It's possible that he wore it when he sacrificed on his altar. It's possible that he had it erected and people came when they offered their sacrifices, could see this ephod. It's somewhat likely that they used it to divine God's will for matters. And all of these things are against God's law. All of them, he told them, you cannot do these things. You may not do these things at all. They were to go to Shiloh for worship and their assembly point, not Ophrah. So I don't know how it came about, but all of those seem to be reasonable conjectures. You set that in contrast with how the book of Judges handles Shiloh, corporate worship, and the role of the Levites, and you'll find that the book is completely devoid of any positive mention of the role of Levites and of corporate worship, with the one exception of Phinehas in the latter end of the book, when he finally got Israel to assemble and repent before the Lord and offer their sacrifices. So there's no good news in the book of Judges regarding the worship of the people of God. And we have these two distinct categories, or these two distinct events, which take place in the life of Israel, which led them astray. Not from worshiping a false god. We're not talking about Baal and Ashtoreth worship. We're talking about worshiping the true God the wrong way. And that's what they did with the with Micah's idolatry, and it appears is what happened again with Gideon and his ephod. I don't think there's any reason to suppose that Gideon had the wrong intentions in mind when he started. The scriptures put Gideon forth as a man of faith, a man of valor and humility and good judgment, but there does seem to be that this incident was the catalyst for bringing Israel to a dismal state in the years to come. So I think we're running over in time, and we'll end there in verse 27. We'll pick up the rest of this chapter next week.